Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi there, how are you?
I am fine. Happy holidays.
Thanks, you too.
Evidently, we got that white stuff.
Some of it, anyway.
Yeah, that four-letter word. I don't love the cold and snow, but it is pretty for a minute or two. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, are you ready for the holiday?
Next subject.
Got it. Well, perhaps our show, for those who are listening, whether they are or are not ready, will be a nice respite from last-minute hustle and bustle. There's a new spin, yes again, on Lance Armstrong. This time, Travis Tigert, head of USADA, said in an article published in The Guardian this week, "We're here to take the heat for clean athletes." The straight-talking U.S. anti-doping chief says it is still not too late for the disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong to tell the truth and embrace being a solution rather than an ongoing problem. Quote, "Somebody said the mob left Vegas and it took over the U.S. pro cycling team. The evidence supports it," said Travis Tigert, chief executive of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. He also said, "Remember, we gave Armstrong an opportunity to come in and be truthful. That was probably the lowest point for me because I really thought the change for sport and the legacy of this effort could have been huge, far bigger, if he had embraced being a solution rather than the ongoing problem." He says it's not too late for Armstrong to change his mind and tell the truth. I, for one, do not think that's going to happen. But I just thought it was interesting that Travis Tigert actually was interviewed and came out in that. Not a simple solution for Armstrong.
Yeah. I don't think Lance thinks he did anything wrong.
Interesting.
So he probably doesn't feel like he has anything to confess or to admit to.
Interesting perspective. One I hadn't actually...
Who knows what's going on inside the mind of somebody like that?
That's true. That's very, very true.
He tweeted a picture of himself lounging on a couch in Hawaii underneath seven framed tour yellow jerseys.
That's true. I remember that picture.
That takes some big cojones.
Yeah.
To do that.
Wait, we can't go there with Lance, remember? That was the problem in the first place. All right. Anyway, you have an anecdote. You said what?
His one is probably bigger than most men's set.
Okay.
Probably.
We're moving on. What's your anecdote?
So I've been meaning to share this with our listeners.
Okay.
For a while, and I keep forgetting every time we get to the station. So finally, I've remembered it, and maybe this will be a little bit of holiday humor. Not holiday-related humor, but humor for your holiday season.
Okay.
This is for road cyclists who ride on streets where there are traffic lights. And this is a surefire way to make a red light turn to green.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, let me hear it.
I got it. I'm telling you.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready.
Proven to work. Uh-huh. Tested over thousands of miles.
Okay.
When you approach a red light, you're getting closer, first thing you do is start to soft pedal. Okay?
Okay, yeah.
And if it doesn't turn green, then the next step is coast.
Right.
Okay.
As long as you're not riding a fixie, that works.
Right. If once you get, too close to the intersection, maybe you need to start braking gently. So we're escalating the pressure on the red light here.
Can't figure out where we're going here.
When you get up to where you finally have to reckon with the red light, slow to a crawl that is just shy of a track stand, but don't track stand.
Okay.
Because that's...
Have you clipped out yet?
No. Don't
okay.
clip out yet.
Okay.
But don't... Track standing is just wrong.
Boy, so, are you going to get some flack on that one?
I probably will. Yeah. But you can do that thing where you're still inching and staying.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it still doesn't turn, okay, it might turn by then, but if it still doesn't turn, clip 1 foot out and place it on the pavement. As soon as you do that,
the light will change.
The light will change.
That is probably true.
Now, in rare cases, even putting a foot on the pavement will not prompt the light to change.
So
the next step is, and this works the best, if you got to the intersection first and then cars have started to queue up behind you,
mm-hmm.
reach down for your water bottle and get it out to take a drink. That is the absolute guarantee, because as soon as you have put a foot down, you're taking a drink, and there's 10 cars behind you that really want to go now,
right?
That's when the light will change.
Okay, then.
So just offering this as a holiday public service to all road cyclists.
Okay, then. I wonder if anybody else is going to write in or call in or whatever and say, wait, I have my method to make the light change. And by the way, I'd be interested in hearing other methods besides Greg's. But I get what you're saying. You know,
sure,
you do everything right up to that moment of grab your water bottle.
If you're listening and you have what you think is a superior method for red light changing to green,
we're all ears.
Definitely let me know. I will personally field test it and single blind study. Let you know which
method works.
Because
I'm going to take his glasses away, single blind study. All right. Are we moving on?
Yes.
Okay. I'm delighted to welcome two women to the show this evening. It's an all-girl show. Well, except for you. I don't think we've done an all-girl show in a long time, if ever. I can't really remember. So many of you know that I'm a certified yoga instructor, and I believe that yoga and bicycling create a natural connection to one another. Now, I haven't been able to convince Greg yet, but I'm telling you. Rather than take my word for it, though, our first guest this evening is Kelly Reffer. Kelly lives and practices yoga and rides a bike in Seattle, Washington, and has written one of the best books I've seen that simply and openly makes the connection between yoga and cycling. It's titled Pedal, Stretch, Breathe, The Yoga of Cycling. It's a small paperback book with great illustrations done by Kelly, short chapters, and simple explanations of how you can not only make the connection, but also will find yoga fun and helpful. Our second guest has been with us before. So way back in the early spring of 2011, her name is Ellie Blue. She's well known among cycling enthusiasts in the Pacific Northwest and beyond for her prolific writing and spot-on commentaries about transportation issues. We're going to speak with her this evening about her new book, Everyday Bicycling, How to Ride a Bike for Transportation, Whatever Your Lifestyle, and catch up with some of the other projects on Ellie's plate. In fact, Ellie's little company published both her book, Everyday Bicycling, and Kelly's book, Pedal, Stretch, Breathe. So along with our interviews, we'll have some news. So let's get right to it and welcome author and yoga instructor Kelly Reffer to The Outspoken Cyclist. Kelly, thanks for joining us this evening. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation between two yoga instructors.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Good. How's Seattle today?
Pretty rainy and pretty chilly, but other than that, it's usual wonderful self.
Are you from Seattle originally?
No, I'm from Colorado. My parents live in Littleton. I'm actually going to head that way on Saturday.
Oh, good. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to cycling and yoga?
Absolutely. I am a yoga teacher in Seattle. I've been teaching here for 3 years. And I'm also the author of Pedal, Stretch, Breathe, The Yoga of Bicycling, which is a really small book. And my relationship with cycling really took off after I graduated college and lived in Denver for a year. I rode my bike around as my primary mode of transit, and then after getting my yoga certification, decided to move to Seattle and teach there. And I continued riding my bike ever since, and ride my bike almost every day.
Are you an artist?
I did all the drawings. I am an artist, yeah. I studied art history and have always just been crafty and made things, and I loved the creative part of making this book.
So when you decided to write this book, were you teaching in a studio? Is that what you do? Do you teach for a studio?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I primarily teach for the Grinning Yogi right now. It's
a
studio
name.
In Capitol Hill. Very happy little wonderful yoga studio. But I also teach at some other gyms and locations around Seattle. I'm just teaching all over.
The book sort of brings to mind that you teach a pretty traditional yoga practice. Is that true? You're not doing like Bikram yoga or Anusara yoga or Ashtanga yoga. It looks like it's a pretty practical yoga class.
Yeah, I definitely like accessible yoga. I actually was trained kind of in a variety of yogas. I'm kind of a yoga mutt, so I pull from a bunch of different backgrounds. But I want to be a teacher that is really clear and is able to communicate yoga to people who've never done it before.
So the book, and I think that's what we're going to focus on here, takes a different approach to the traditional yoga being in a studio. You actually are showing a lot of asanas or postures with the bicycle itself. So can you explain the format of your book and how you decided to meld yoga and cycling the way you did?
Absolutely. Yeah, so yoga and cycling just came together for me, and it was it started actually with the drawings. I was submitted some artwork of yoga with your bike for Ellie Blue, my publisher of Taking the Lane, her issue Our Bodies, Our Bikes. And that kind of spurred the whole thing. It started actually with the doing yoga with your bike outside. And for me, that's really where the inspiration came from. I love going on a long bike ride and stopping at a park or beach and doing some yoga, just standing up outside. And so that's really what drew me to this idea. I wanted something that people could kind of take with them on their ride and do out and about in the city on the bike path.
So you're looking at yoga from a very holistic outdoor perspective, which I think is very refreshing. So you're not sort of confined to the four walls of a studio.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want something that people can do in their daily commute. Like I said, I ride my bike pretty much every day, and I'm not usually going to roll out my yoga mat in my living room and do 15 minutes of a home practice before going on a bike ride. But I will take the time to do maybe a string of three or four yoga poses and hold them for a few breaths. And that's usually enough to just help me feel a little bit more present in my body, a little more aware, ready to ride my bike.
In fact, that's pretty much how you talk about starting out, the importance of staying present. Do you want to sort of define staying present and why it's so important on the bike? Because you really make some good points about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I feel so. The idea of staying present is, I think, a central principle to yoga. Instead of letting your mind pay attention to earlier today or what you're going to do later tonight, really focus on the now and the moment. And I feel that's such a good tool to pull onto your everyday bike riding. When you're more present, when you're staying with your breath and your body, you're not only aware of yourself in space, which helps keep you safer, but you're also more aware of what's going on around you on the traffic and city streets. And I think that awareness allows you to react quicker when the unexpected happens in traffic, which it does all the time.
Right, right. I just think it's a really good beginning to the book. Tell us about your pre-ride flow chart. I thought that was really cool too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the whole pedal, stretch, breathe thing. It's like a little flow chart that was inspired out of one of those quizzes you might find in some sort of magazine. Like if you ask a question, you can go to this option or that option.
Right.
But I threw out some pictures of different yoga postures you can do, and I feature some you can do with your bicycle. And it's just kind of a quick way for people to look out and see, like, okay, well, maybe I could do these two things right before I do my morning ride. And my quads are usually tight by the time I need to bike home, so maybe I'll try this quad stretch on the way home. And it's just really, simple, practical poses that aren't that hard, but really make a big difference in your body.
A lot of people think that yoga is just another stretching practice. In a very short and compact way, you show how it's really a lot more. Talk a little bit about the connection of the chakras to the bicycle. First of all, why don't you explain what the chakras are for those who do not know?
Okay, well, chakras are really funny, but they are hard to explain. Like, they're just weird, but it's along the spine. So we all have a spinal column, and we all know that's a really important part of our body. And there are major energy centers along the spine. There are seven of the primary ones, and each one of those is the chakras. And there's a lot of different traits associated with each one. And that can include like a color or a sound or certain developmental issues or certain yoga postures. There's all kinds of ways you can study chakras. I don't know if that's a brief interview, but hopefully that gives people a little bit of an idea.
Well, there are seven, as you say, and they start at sort of the base of your spine and move all the way up to the crown of your head. So,
yeah, that's a great point. Starts from the bottom, goes on up to the top of your head.
Right. So how do you associate the chakras with yoga and then with cycling? How are you putting that together?
You know, it's mostly for kind of fun and for my own thought experiment. I enjoy studying the chakras. I read a really wonderful book called Eastern Body, Western Mind by Anandeya Judas, all about the chakras, and just found it really fascinating. And I was riding my bike at the time a lot too, and just sort of thought about how you learn a lot of bike maintenance from the ground up. The first thing you learn is the flat tire. That's kind of the root. You need some air in your tires, and then you can be on your way. And so I started to sort of make this link of like investigating your chakras is kind of like investigating bike maintenance. And it's a little bit of a stretch, but it's kind of fun to start thinking about it. And the one that really kind of sealed the deal is like there's a connection was the solar plexus chakra, which is our center of power, our center of will. That really connected to me for the drivetrain because it's this part of the bike that you have a lot of control over. You can really go incredibly fast and charge up a hill, or you can kind of just mosey about along the road. So I found that was kind of a fun link to make between the body and the bicycle.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kelly Reefer. She's got a new book. It is called Pedal, Stretch, Breathe, The Yoga of Bicycling. And I have to admit, it's one of the few yoga bicycle books that I'm very intrigued with. I really like it. Most of you know that I am also a certified yoga instructor. So this was a lot of fun to read. One of the things I noticed right away after spending a lot of time doing yoga, especially over a winter, was that it made such a difference in my climbing ability on the bike.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yoga builds strength and stamina and endurance. But I think one of the practices of yoga that makes yoga more than that stretching practice, that makes it really unique, is the focus on breath. And when we start to really pay attention to our breathing, we get a lot more power. In yoga, breath is translated to like prana or life force. And it really is what powers us up those hills. And it's, you know, the high performance athletes know that if you really focus on breath and lung capacity, you're going to improve your performance. But even if you're just, you know, a mom with a kid on the back of your bike, focusing on your breathing will improve your performance.
It'll also improve your balance.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so we do a lot of balancing in yoga class. So,
absolutely.
Do you have any plans to follow this up with another yoga and bicycle sort of project?
Well, I do. We're actually going to be doing an extended edition of Pedal, Stretch, Breathe. I found a few more things I wanted to write about and draw and focus on. So I'll be doing an extended edition that will even have a spine. It will be a little bit bigger, as well as some kind of notebooks that will coordinate along with it. That'll be mostly the artwork. And so it's just going to be a set that'll be coming out at some point next year, but probably sooner rather than later because I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. So how many classes do you teach a week?
Oh, it kind of ranges. I have 6 regular classes a week, and then, you know, sometimes you pick up more, sometimes you sub things out. You never know. It's always kind of changing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how people can actually get a copy of Pedal, Stretch, Breathe. Where can they go?
Well, one place to go is my blog and website, pedalstretchbreathe.com. I have on the right sidebar, there's a image of the cover of the book, and you can order it through me in PayPal. Another option is through Taking the Lane Media, takingthelane.com. And if you're in the Seattle area, there are a few stores that will be stocking it. including Rainbow Remedies, Hub and Bespoke in Fremont, a few other places about town.
So my last question is about your relationship with Ellie Blue, who's going to be on the show right after you. So the question is, how did you meet Ellie? Because actually, it was her company that published your book, yes?
Yes, it was.
So how did you meet Ellie?
I met Ellie through my partner, Tom, who does the Seattle bike blog. And he had gone to a bike event in Seattle and met Ellie there. And I didn't meet her then. And he came back from this event and he was like, I met this really cool person, Ellie. You'd love her. And the next time Ellie was in town, we met for coffee and just, you know, instantly got along and started kind of scheming up different things from that meeting. And since then, Ellie lives in Portland and I live in Seattle. So it's a pretty easy back and forth between the two cities.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking with Ellie again. We've actually had her on the show before, and we're sort of, you know, off and on. We have a little conversation now and then. Well, I wish you a lot of luck with the book, Kelly. It's really easy to read. It's fun to read. It's fun to look at. And for those people who are afraid to get into yoga, it might be one of those books that just pushes you over the edge. I think that would be great.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. Have a happy holiday.
You too. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, Dan. Bye.
Kelly Reefer is the author of Pedal, Stretch, Breathe, The Yoga of Bicycling, and she joined us from Seattle, Washington.
Yes, it was nice to speak with another yoga instructor. She's so bubbly, such a happy girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe yoga does make you happier.
I don't know about you, Greg. Is anything going to make you happier?
You couldn't do anything for me, even yoga?
You know what? You and I have had this conversation more than once, and you promised you'd come to a class. That hasn't happened yet.
It's all about time.
Uh-huh.
It's all about time.
Remember, nobody ever went to his or her grave saying, gee, I wish I'd spent more time at the office.
I read part of this little book while you were interviewing Kelly.
Isn't it good?
Mm-hmm.
I do like it, you know, and I really am not one of those people who believes that there is yoga for cyclists or yoga for swimmers or yoga for highlight or whatever it is. But I think the way she's integrated the idea of the breath and just the movement and using the bike to do some of the postures, I think she's done a really nice job. For somebody who's really only been teaching 3 years, she's done a really, really good job with it.
Wow.
I'm impressed.
Well, on that note, let's check out some news before we head to the break.
Okay. We do have a little bit of news this week. This is from Velo News, and maybe it's some refreshing news. Two young Americans punched their Euro tickets with La Pomme. It's by Andrew Hood. It was published on Thursday the 19th from León, Spain. Two promising American talents have landed rides at one of Europe's most storied development teams for 2013. Officials from La Palme Marseille Bonita, spawning ground for scores of contemporary pros, confirmed that Robert Bush and Joshua Berry will join the France-based Continental squad for next year. Both riders come across from the Chipotle First Solar Development team, which is likely shuttering, and bring some impressive results to the table. Bush, 22, is the reigning U23 national champion and won the U23 national crit title in 2011, while Barry, also 22, was third in the U23 Liège-Bastogne-Liège this season when compatriot Ian Boswell, now at Sky, finished second. The team's website did confirm their respective arrivals, posting the message that, quote, the two new recruits, perhaps not well known to the public, are certainly not novices in the field. The competition better watch out. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some clean riders. It's funny. I will mention this because she's coming on the show in January. But a rider who retired from the sport and who never doped, and who, it's interesting that she didn't really know exactly what was going on around her. She rode during the days of Eddie B. and Rebecca Twigg back in the 80s. Inga Thompson was talking about how it's nice to see some young riders who are now coming into the sport and will remain clean because their mothers will kill them if they don't. So, like Taylor Finney, for example. So I think that's very, very cool. Have you ever taken a Vermont bicycle tour?
I have not. But they're very famous.
They are very famous. They are very famous. And what's interesting is Vermont Bicycle Tours is now Discovery Bicycle Tours. They have changed their name. Welcome to our 37th year is the way their new website, which is really their old website, but under the new name. Our big, big news this year is that we have changed our name from Bike Vermont to Discovery Bicycle Tours. We feel this new name better reflects the fact that we tour not only in Vermont, but also Maine, Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, Maryland, California, which is new this year, Quebec, Italy, Ireland, Scotland, and Spain. Be assured, however, that this is a name change only. We are still, in heart and soul, the same old Bike Vermont, and will never lose our focus and essential character as the smaller, friendlier bike touring company. Larry Niles, I think, is the guy who runs Bike Vermont. Really, really a nice company, and a lot of my customers have taken their tours. Unfortunately, I've never had an opportunity to take one, but I've never heard anybody say anything bad about them. So congratulations. I think that's very cool. Very, very cool. It's kind of hard to change your name and then not lose customers. So I hope they don't. I hope they do really, really well. We all have been talking about the fiscal cliff.
Mm-hmm.
This is the container cliff. Shipping firm says East Coast strike likely as talks break down. This comes from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News from Miami, Florida. They're not actually naming names, but a major shipping logistics firm says that the likelihood of a strike is high after contract negotiations broke down this week between the Longshoremen's Union and East Coast port operators. Now, how that affects the bicycle business is a lot of bikes coming from the Orient come in through those ports. So we'll just have to kind of stay tuned to see what's going on with that. So the container cliff, I thought that was kind of
interesting. They just got the Longshoremen's strike in San Diego and Los Angeles ports resolved not that long ago.
Yeah. So, and right about now is when all these containers start to arrive for spring.
With the new bikes,
the 2013s. Yeah. In some cases, they're already here, but you know. So my last little story today is from England by our friend Carlton Reed at Bike Biz. Tory MPs fight for their constituencies to host Le Tour in 2014. Minister said sports cycling will benefit everyday cycling. So yesterday in Parliament, it was revealed a new all-party parliamentary group would be set up to coordinate support for Le Tour's outing to Yorkshire and London in 2014. However, it was the spectacle of Yorkshire's Tory MPs tussling to see who had the most bicycle-friendly constituencies that was the most gripping aspect of the one-and-a-half-hour debate. MPs know that a visit from Le Tour would be of huge financial benefit to their constituencies and were falling all over themselves to be as bike-friendly as possible and talked about everyday cycling, not just cycle sport. The debate has been secured by Julian Smith, the Tory MP for Skipton and Ripon. He said Yorkshire was, quote, God's own country and will wow the world in July 2014. He predicted that the first three stages of Le Tour in 2014 will be the best ever. In 2007, the tour stages in the southeast of England were worth £88 million to the region. It's estimated that the Grand Depart in Yorkshire could be worth more than £300 million. For an area of Britain that has weathered the global economic storm but is finding things tough, the event will make a real difference, said Smith. So even in England, people duke it out over this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's big business,
bucks.
Big economic impact to bring a sporting event like that through a region.
Right. I'd love to see some big tours come through Northeast Ohio, but I guess they're going to stay on the West Coast and in Colorado for now.
The transit from the U.S. back to France is a little bit long, I think, for to ever see the Tour de France come here.
Well, this is not that tour, but yeah, this is a British tour. But
making a sarcastic.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed it totally, right over my head. Big surprise. All right, I'll bet you're going to say maybe we need to take a break now.
I think you need to take a break. I'm still feeling fresh over here,
but
if you need one, I'll be happy to oblige.
Okay. I thought we needed to take a
when
break.
When we come back, we're going to speak with someone who's been on the show in the past.
Yeah, my friend Ellie Blue from Portland, Oregon, is going to talk about her new book, Everyday Bicycling.
All right. So stay tuned for that in just a moment on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now, before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
Nurse, set up an IV. And you, her boyfriend, you were the driver?
Yes, doctor, but I didn't mean to hurt her. I only had a few drinks. I was just buzzed.
Just buzzed? Oh, then your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie, I feel great.
She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No, not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
If you're just joining us, I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Yes,
and,
we are.
And we're going to move right ahead to our second and final guest for the hour.
I'd like to welcome back to the show Ellie Blue. She is in Portland, Oregon, a very prolific writer and just has some really cool projects on her plate every day. Right now, her new book, Everyday Bicycling, How to Ride a Bike for Transportation, Whatever Your Lifestyle, was just published this month. Good evening, Ellie. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's going to be fun to catch up with you again.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much for having me on again. It was so much fun last time.
Yeah, it was fun. I remember. So you've been up to some interesting things since the last time we spoke, and it was like, gosh, it doesn't seem like a year and a half ago.
I can't believe that.
I know, March of 2011. I looked it up. Would you give us a bit of what's been going on in your world, and then we're going to talk about your new book.
Well, let's see. I've continued to be an outspoken advocate for bicycling, and I've gotten involved in the women's bicycling movement at the national level. The League of American Bicyclists has a new program called Women Bike, and they are really taking the lead in not just saying, hey, we should have more women involved in bicycling, but saying, hey, women have always been involved in bicycling. Time for us to step up and take credit and, you know, take charge in steering this ship in a really positive direction. So I'm super excited about that. And then I wrote my book, Everyday Bicycling, which just came out, and I'm already deep into work on my next book, which is about bicycling and the economy, called Bikonomics. Mm-hmm. It makes the economic case for bicycle transportation, and I'm thinking that one might just change the world. We'll see.
That would be nice. It's time for the world to change.
Exactly. I mean, I have a small publication about that that's just 40 pages and just lays out some basic facts without a lot of fanfare, and the feedback I get back from that is people give it to their city councilor and they take it to their advocacy organization, and that it really, having the facts about bicycle economics really helps inspire people to, you know, kind of make real changes instead of just asking for incremental changes.
So right.
That's the hope. So having a mainstream book out there in every Barnes & Noble in the country, I'm hoping will make a big difference.
One of the things I want to talk about before we actually delve into everyday bicycling is just the scope of your publishing structure. So you are a prolific writer. You've written this book. You've got the other book. You've got your Taking the Lane and cantankerous titles. I love that. That's awesome.
Especially then my boyfriend's operation. But
well, and then Pedal, Stretch, Breathe. We just talked to Kelly a few minutes ago.
Oh,
so,
good.
Yeah, this is an all-girl show today.
That's right.
So explain how you got into this whole thing with publishing and writing. I mean, you also have written for Grist and a whole bunch of other publications. You just like, write. You must write all day, every day.
I wish I wrote all day, every day. That's actually a constant problem in my life is I'm so busy, you know, scheduling production things and designing things and responding to emails that I almost don't have time to actually sit and write, but I do try to as much as possible. I have a lot of different things going on. There's actually a little bit of a or a lot of a sort of bicycle-oriented publishing revolution going on in Portland, particularly right now. And I think in part that's because the mainstream publishing industry is sort of growing so big that it almost can't publish anything that fewer than 50,000 people will read, which leaves a lot of room for small presses to kind of make it big, and particularly when it comes to niche topics like bicycling that people have a lot of interest in, but that are, you know, still small enough that a big company might not want to take a chance on a book. So I actually, my publishing business is called Taking the Lane, and I do a quarterly series of kind of nonfiction magazines, essays about bicycling, a different topic. I'm about to send the disaster issue to press, people writing about how bicycling plays into different disasters and disaster preparedness and recovering from emergencies. And then I have been publishing standalone books also. So one is Pedal Stretch Breathe by Kelly Reifer. And then my next book is called The Culinary Cyclist, which is kind of it's almost sort of a cookbook or a lifestyle book for people who ride bicycles and who love food. And then I also have a book called How to Be Fast or Look Good Trying, which is a snarky guide to beginners bicycle racing. So those are the next two coming up. And that one is by Lindsay Condra, and The Culinary Cyclist is by Anna Bronas and Johanna Kinval.
So I've got some new people to interview coming up soon.
Yes, you will.
That will be awesome.
Sure to call you.
So let's talk about everyday bicycling. It is a nice size book that you could even take with you. How to Ride a Bike for Transportation and parenthetically, whatever your lifestyle. It was just released this month, which is very cool. So I'm really glad to talk to you now. It's got lots of good advice and ideas to help folks become confident and, more importantly, in some ways, interested in riding a bike for everyday transportation. So when did you first begin to ride and use a bike for transportation?
Ooh, I was 20 years old, and I found my old bike from childhood in my parents' garage, and I had not really gotten comfortable riding it as a child. And I now know that this was because it was much too large for me, and since it fit me perfectly when I was 20. And I just started riding. I don't know if I had a plan or if I had, I don't remember what I was thinking around it, but I just remember, like, I started riding. I rode on the sidewalk. I rode probably the wrong way in the street. I rode in a very unsafe and untransportation-like manner, but I just had so much fun. And then I gradually sort of got to know the bike and figured out what to wear and what not to wear. And riding everyday bicycling really brought me back to when I first discovered that bicycle and all the really dumb things that I did that, you know, now looking back, it's hard to even remember why it would have occurred to me to wear a pencil skirt and try to bike to work on a rainy day. But
right.
That wardrobe malfunction, you know, it didn't even occur to me at the time that anything bad could come of that. And, you know, it's burned in my memory forever now.
I had to do a visual on pencil skirt, but I've got it since I wear jeans about 99% of the time. Really.
And I do now also, which is, you know, perhaps a function of the bicycling lifestyle I've taken on. But
yeah, maybe. So,
but, you know, yeah, I think a lot of the barriers to bicycling, like people who want to bike, I think a lot of it really is really small things like, can I ride in my normal clothes? Can I ride in my yoga pants? Will something go wrong? And, like, you just don't even know what questions to ask. So that was part of my inspiration for the book.
Well, it goes into a fair amount of detail about the kinds of bikes you can use for urban riding. You want to elaborate on it a little bit? I mean, it shows on the front cover a really nice cargo bike with probably a mom, and the kids are in the front.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a dad, but, you know, one of these sort of low-slung, long cargo bikes. So what are some of the bikes? I guess you could use anything for urban riding, but you sort of go into detail in the book.
Yeah, and I mean, in part, like, I do believe you can use any bike at all for urban transportation. And I think for a lot of people just getting started, it's better to just start with whatever is available and then sort of learn what works for you and what doesn't and kind of move on. I think a lot of people don't start riding bikes at first because they just don't know what kind of bike to get, and they think they have to, like, get it right the first time. And I mean, I have a section in there called You Don't Have to Marry Your Bicycle. Like, if you choose the wrong bike at first, you can, like, figure that out, sell it, and move on. There's no shame involved. But as far as, like, the best bikes for urban transportation, it really depends on your needs. And I think it really depends on what or who you need to carry. So if you're carrying children on your bike, you'll want a very different setup than if you really just want to, like, go to work and back, and it's really fast, and maybe you don't need to carry groceries that often.
Do you think you need more than one bike?
It depends on the person. I went through much of my bicycling life with only one bike, and then I remember the first time I had two bikes that I rode regularly. It was like this amazing feeling. I felt so free. I was like, oh, I can go fast if I want, or I can carry all my groceries if I want. I don't have to choose. So I think, you know, if you only have room in your apartment or room in your budget for one bike, there are some really good options available. But if you have room in your life for multiple bikes, I'm sure many people listening to this can sympathize with the, you know, with the way that plays out.
Yes, we usually top out. We say, well, if you've got seven or more, you're considered crazy. So
is that per person or per household?
Per person.
Okay, good.
Per person. No. Per household. Oh, I think a lot of people are, you know, that would limit way too many people. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Ellie Blue. She's in Portland, and she's written a new book called Everyday Bicycling, How to Ride a Bike for Transportation, Whatever Your Lifestyle. So we touched on women and kids riding, and I think that that's a really important subject, because a lot of women would ride their bikes more just to run errands if they knew that their kids could be safe on bikes. You have some tips for women that make it more doable than perhaps some people think?
Well, just a disclaimer, I don't have kids. So when I wrote this chapter, there's a really strong bicycling community among parents in Portland. So
nice.
A bunch of mothers and fathers wrote in and had just, you know, the best things to say. And I kept asking all of them in my initial questions and in my follow-up questions, like, what are the downsides? And none of them would say. None of them would say anything. One of them, I was like, does rain bother you? And they were all like, no. I was like, your kids ever not want a bike? And they were like, well, of course, sometimes they don't want to, but there's always something kids don't want to do sometimes. So that was pretty eye-opening. They all had really, really good tips. But I think the big one, the thread that kind of came out, was, like, find other people who are doing it. If they're in your community or go to your school, that's great. But even if you find them on the Internet, there's a ton of parenting blogs out there that are gaga for bicycles. So, you know, so their main thing was, like, find someone to, like, share the stories of the good days and the bad days with. Find someone to, like, tell you in great detail about, you know, what kind of cargo bike setup they have and what their kids like and what their kids don't like. And just find people to do it with, and it'll be more fun and you'll feel better and safer about it.
Right. I think safety is a big concern for many, many women. So you also sort of emphasize in the book that you should be pretty self-sustaining, meaning you do your own work on your bike, so you learn about your bike. Do you recommend that somebody actually, you know, do all the mechanical work on the bike?
Oh, gosh, not unless they want to.
Okay.
I mean, I think one of the great things about bicycling is that you can go as far with it as you want to, you know, like for me, I discovered that, like, I've always thought of myself as not very mechanical, and I've discovered that I do actually really enjoy tinkering with my bike. I just don't love doing it when it's raining and I have a flat tire and it's an emergency. And so I actually mostly take my bike to the shop, even for, like, super simple things. I find that, like, I can either, and maybe this is the problem of having more than one bicycle, but recently I just completely wore the brake pads on my cargo bike down to nothing, and it sat there for 2 weeks, and I didn't ride it, and I didn't go and do the things I didn't needed to do on it. And finally, I was just like, okay, I'm going to take it into the shop because I know I'm not going to actually get around to doing this 10-minute thing myself.
Sure.
And it's worth the $20 to support a local business and have them do it. And I think, you know, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Some people never want to touch their bikes or do any maintenance, and that's great. Like, they keep local, those people are the bread and butter of local bike shops, and we need local bike shops to stay around. There's also bikes you can get that need less maintenance, like some of the Dutch bikes that are imported. You almost never need to go in and fiddle with the chain or anything because all of their components are enclosed. But I've also, you know, just discovering that I can fix my own bike and do things that seem really complicated or that used to seem really complicated. You can go on the internet and read a few things and watch a video and, like, repack your own hubs, and it's not actually that much of an ordeal, and it feels really good to be able to do that. So I'm an advocate of people, you know, going to their comfort level, maybe pushing a little beyond it, and then not, you know, worrying about being dogmatic about anything like that.
I mean, there are certain things I can do. I've worked in a bike shop for 39 years, and there are certain things I wouldn't even begin to touch. But on the other hand, you know, I can certainly change a tire and lube a chain and check a headset and do that kind of stuff. So, but I don't true wheels. That I don't fool around with.
Oh, see, that's the one thing that I will, like, jump at the chance to do. I love
chewing
wheels.
Oh, that's cool.
I hate changing flat tires beyond anything, but chewing wheels, it's like meditating.
Interesting. Maybe it's because I'm left-handed, which, of course, that was sort of a dig at my partner who says I blame everything on being left-handed, which I do. Anyway, I want to talk for a moment on how you suggest that potential riders, especially women, get over the fear of riding on the road. What would you suggest for people who say, I'm never going to ride on the road, that is the problem?
I don't know. I mean, I think people interact with fear differently, you know. Like, I've gone through moments of my bicycling life when I just feel afraid. Whenever I'm not on my bike, I'm afraid to get on my bike, and I have to really push past that fear to get on it. And then I've also, and that's, sometimes I'll feel that way for a month, and then that feeling will just go away. And I don't know, sometimes I just take the bus a lot for that month. And then other times I feel totally confident, and I'm willing to, like, go fast down any major road and take the lane and assert my right to the road. And most of the time I prefer to stick to, Portland has a really good network of well-marked, quieter neighborhood streets that you can get around town on. It's not quite as fast as taking the main road. So, I mean, I would say, like, start with slow streets, get confident, make sure that you can, like, start going uphill without wobbling too much, make sure you're, like, really comfortable knowing, like, being able to look over your shoulder without swerving into a parked car, you know, like get yourself feeling comfortable and confident on the bike, and then the roads, the confidence in being able to handle yourself on different kinds of roads will come. And I think, I mean, when I first started riding, honestly, I had a boyfriend who was getting me into it, and I don't think he remembered what it was like to first start riding, so he took me to New York City, and this was, like, before the bike lanes in Manhattan, and we rode on New York City streets, and it was the most terrifying day of my entire life, and it was so much fun. I had so much fun. It was like a roller coaster, but I was also not eager to go do it again.
Right.
Because my heart was racing, so I think a lot of people, when they're like helping their partner get excited about bicycling, maybe they forget to think, like, okay, maybe it's not better to jump in the deep end right away, you know?
Right. Right.
But at the same time, like, when you're in a car, the road looks really different than when you're on a bike. Like, it's actually almost scarier, I think, when you're in a car to be on a road, and imagine being on a bicycle on that road, because you're sitting so high and you're so aware of the car around you. But when you're on a bicycle on that road, you, like, look back and you see a car and you see that you have plenty of space, and it's just not as big a deal. So getting out there and trying it, I think, is really, really helpful, so long as you're not getting out there and trying it on a state highway, you know?
Yeah, exactly. A 55-mile-an-hour road.
So, yeah, and we need better roads without cars going as fast on them, and we need fewer cars and slower traffic. I mean, it really just comes down to that, you know, like, separated bikeways are great, and building confident road handling skills is great, but we need safer streets. So, and riding bikes actually helps create safer streets. When there's a lot of people riding bikes, the more people that are riding bikes on a certain stretch of road, the safer that road becomes for everybody on that road. It's been measured in many countries and many cities. So that's, you know, one thing you can do to create road safety is get out there and ride your bike.
I think that's excellent advice. And I think there are statistics that support that. Absolutely. So one of the last chapters in your book is about getting organized. We had a Women's Bike Summit last September, and I think that that advocacy was part of that. We have the LAB. Are you working with Carolyn Sapansky at the LAB? Is she the one heading that up? Yeah, that's what I thought. So what do you mean about getting organized in the book, as you mentioned it in the book?
Well, like I said about the family cyclists, how they found, you know, aside from all the, you know, there's all these questions you can ask, like, what kind of bike should I have? How should I ride it? What's the best way to feel safe on the road? But really, everybody I talked to for the book, the family cyclists, the solo cyclists, everybody said the main thing that encouraged them and sustained them and made them continue to really feel like bicycling was fun was kind of having community around them, having people to ride with sometimes, having, you know, knowing they weren't the only ones doing it. And so I think one of the most powerful forms of advocacy is just getting people together to ride bikes together. Or, you know, if it's winter and things are complicated, just get people together to drink beer together and talk about bikes, or to drink coffee together and talk about bikes. These are, I think, really powerful ways for people to kind of take charge of their local community and kind of learn about the issues and learn about what they might be able to do about them. And then once you've identified a need, that's the next step is obviously to take it to City Hall and start getting people motivated to make real changes on the ground.
And you do mention that. You say approaching City Hall. That is one of the last parts of the book, and advocacy case studies and bikes and party politics. And politics, you know, does right now with the transportation bill the way it is, you know, cycling is sort of on the short end of the stick. So the more people who are involved, the more likely we are to see bicycling come back into the transportation budget. I know you have lots of other projects, but would you let our listeners know how they could get a copy of Everyday Bicycling, How to Ride a Bike for Transportation?
Yes, they can get a copy of Everyday Bicycling by going to everydaybicycling.com, and that will take them to the publisher's website. And they can also order the book as well as my other books directly from me at takingthelane.com.
Okay. So there's a whole bunch of ways to get it.
Yes.
That's great. Well, and it's nice. It is small. It is well written. I like the typeface. Obviously, you spend a lot of time thinking about every element of your books, and I appreciate that. You even have a little section on how to make your own panniers.
Oh, yes. That actually...
Is that the kitty litter one?
That is the kitty litter one, although you can use a peanut butter jug, too.
And oh, interesting.
My partner, Joe Beal, who is the publisher and also did all the design and typesetting on the book, he made that illustration and wrote those instructions, which I think is a great addition to the book.
You know, a lot of people talk about the kitty litter panniers, and so it is a great illustration. It really is a nicely written book and has a lot of great information if you ever want to get started riding your bike every day, which of course you and I would hope that everybody would do. Well, I hope you have a wonderful holiday. I'm looking forward to your next books. I just can't believe you can write all this. And I will probably see you at the Bike Summit maybe, yes?
I hope so. I'm happy to hear that you'll be there, yes. I will also be coming to Cleveland in May on tour.
You will?
Mm-hmm. Yep, we'll be there in mid-May, and people can go to dinnerandbikes.com to find out more details.
Wait. Dinnerandbikes.com?
Mm-hmm.
Who's bringing you to Cleveland?
Well, me and my partner, Joe, who's also the publisher of this book, and a vegan chef named Joshua Klug. Every year we go on a tour, a month-long tour of 30 different cities in 30 days. And in 2013, we're going to the Northeast U.S., and Cleveland is definitely an important stop along the way.
Do you know the actual date?
I don't know the actual date or where it will be, but we do have quite a team coming together to organize the event. I think it will probably, I know that the folks at Joy Machines are working on it.
Okay.
And then Lois Moss of Walk and Roll definitely has a hand in it. And I know Cleveland has this huge thriving bike community now, which I'm so excited
We do.
To
I am so excited that you're coming to town. I'll keep an eye on that. Well, Ellie, again, thank you so much for talking with me this evening about everyday bicycling and just about what you're up to.
Thank you so much, Diane. This has been a real pleasure, as always, and I hope to have more news to share with you in another year.
Excellent. Have a good holiday.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ellie Blue is the author of Everyday Bicycling, How to Ride a Bike for Transportation, Whatever Your Lifestyle, among other titles. And she joined us from up in Portland, Oregon.
This book has so much stuff in it. We barely scratched the surface today. I just sort of, you know, picked and a few of the highlights of the book, but it's really, really fun.
Must be very concentrated. Oh, small print.
Small print.
Yeah.
But it's easy to retype, you know, and believe me, my eyes are not, you know, they're old eyes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But anyway, it's a good book.
Good,
I like
good.
It.
All right. And she's coming to Cleveland. So maybe we'll get her in here as a in-person guest. Or
how exciting is that?
Maybe she'll go for a ride with us when she's in town.
Well, considering that it's in May, did she say?
Yeah.
Yeah, we could actually maybe do that. It might even not be snowing.
There you go.
There you go.
Well, we've just passed the solstice, by the way, which I forgot to mention at the top of the show.
Which means the days are going to get longer.
We're officially moving toward more daylight now. And,
wait, did the world end? Did I miss it?
If you're listening to this radio show, it did not end.
Okay, then. Very happy to hear that.
If you can't hear us, the Mayans were right.
There have been a bunch of Mayan jokes this week, by the way.
So anyway, solstice is behind us, Christmas is coming up, and New Year's not far behind.
That's how it usually works.
Yes. Thanks for listening this week and for another year, and we look forward to seeing you one more time in 2012.
Have a very happy and healthy and safe New Year.
Very good. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.